WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In November, John Updike will be honored with the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. Updike has won just about all the big literary awards an American writer can get, with the exception of the Nobel. But Updike's alter ego, Henry Beck, wins the Nobel in Updike's new novel, Beck at Bay. This is Updike's third book about the fictional, moderately successful writer Henry Beck. The first was published in 1970. The Beck stories satirize the writer's life, the literary world, and contemporary culture. I asked Updike to describe Beck.
Henry Beck was born in Manhattan in 1923, which makes him 9 years older than I am. He is a Jewish New Yorker from birth to 76, which is his present age. 75. He is not prolific. He is famous for writing blocks and for having a rather dandyish, exquisitist approach to his writing. He remained unmarried for many years. He has married and divorced and now has a permanent live-in sidekick called Robin. He is, in short, in as many ways as I could think of, not like me. He is my attempt to make a writer who is really an alter ego with the emphasis on alter.
And why did you want to have an alter ego who is so different from you?
In the mid-60s, in 64, I went to Communist Soviet Union, it was then called, and a number of other Eastern European countries as a cultural ambassador of sorts, helping to keep the Cold War from happening. And I had experiences which only a writer could have had. So to unpack one of these experiences, I had to have a writer, and so I invented Henry Beck, being as unlike myself as I could imagine. The story was called The Bulgarian Poetess. Came out in 65, I think. The New Yorker ran it. It even won, I'm proud to say, the first prize, or Henry Award, for that year. So, thus encouraged, I wrote a number of others, and wrote enough, indeed, to make the first book, which was called Beck, a book. And one such book tends to produce another.
Although Beck is very different from you are as a writer and as a person, I think it's fair to say that you use him to unleash some of your views of the literary world.
Yes, I use him to display a few of my wounds, my many wounds, and to write essayistically a little bit about the literary game, the literary racket, which has changed a good bit in the 40-odd years I've been practicing it. So yes, he's a vehicle for a lot of not too serious thoughts about the literary life.
I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt from the chapter called Beck Noir, and this was actually reprinted recently in The New Yorker. And this is a chapter in which he is so wounded by bad reviews he's getting, he starts killing critics. And this is a section in which he's describing just how cutthroat the literary world has become.
Beck had not always been an evil man. He had dedicated himself early to what appeared plainly a good cause, art. It was amusing and helpful to others, he imagined as he emerged from the army, to turn contiguous bits of the world into words, words which, when properly arranged and typeset, possessed a gleam that in wordless reality was lost beneath the daily accretions of habit, worry, and boredom. What harm could there be in art? What enemies could there be? But he discovered that the literary world was a battlefield, mined with hatred, rimmed with snipers.
Does the literary world strike you, John Updike, as a battlefield where jealousy and rivalries are always getting played out?
I think, of course, I don't live in New York, unlike Beck, so I'm just guessing. But yes, I think there's a lot of envy and enmity, and it used to be worse, I suppose, when people took writing more seriously. I think back in the Partisan Review days, you got a lot more really bitter, heartfelt, ideological reviews attacking not just a writer for the quality of his work, but for where he or she stood. But it's like a sinking raft that too many people are trying to get onto the literary world. So naturally, any push you can deliver makes the raft a little higher in the water for you. I think there's a good deal of unexpressed, fortunately unexpressed, I would say, rivalry involved in what should be, strictly speaking, a non-competitive business.
When Beck starts killing off some of his critics, you write, after 50 years of trying to rise above criticism, Beck liberated himself to take it personally. I'm wondering if for you, if you have always felt that you were able to kind of rise above the criticism, or if it ever really wounds more than you'd care to admit.
No, I've had some reviews, especially when I was younger, that I felt were really lethal and hoped to eliminate me from the map. As it turned out, I didn't go away, but for a day or two, I felt pretty low, if there was much truth in what they said. So there was a near-lethal effect here, and it's not so surprising that Henry Beck, as a hyperactive elderly writer, might try to eliminate some of them. The etiquette is you don't respond to a bad review, you take your lumps. After all, you are a writer, and a prize fighter takes his lumps, and your lumps come when a book comes out and it's reviewed. That's the correct attitude, but in fact, down deep, you do take it personally. It does seem almost like sometimes an assault on you who were doing no harm, like you're just walking down the street, smiling and humming, and suddenly, splat, a big mud ball hits you in the face, and you don't see what you've done to deserve the mud ball. So Beck liberates himself, as the passage said, to begin to act upon his real feelings instead of suppress them in the name of literary etiquette.
Of course, you're on both sides because you're not only a writer, but you're also a very active literary critic. Your reviews are published quite frequently in The New Yorker. So you've given and you've gotten. And I'm wondering if the reviews that you've gotten over the years, which have mostly been, you know, really good reviews, but people do say, oh, this is not one of his major works. This is a minor thing for Updike, and, you know, you've gotten your share of reviews that say things like that. Have the reviews that you've gotten over the years affected how you write criticism, how you give it?
I undertook to be a critic in part because I was smarting from reviews I'd received and was determined to model good behavior as a critic. So my initial reviews worked hard at being fair, at trying to understand the author's intention, at being generous, and in dwelling on the book and not upon the reputation of the writer or what I imagine to be his reputation. So the answer is resoundingly yes. Yes, I did try to write good reviews, fair reviews, in the hopes that I would slightly elevate the tone of book reviewing. Not sure I succeeded, and in the process, I certainly wrote a lot more reviews, devoted a lot more of my energy to reviewing books than I wanted to. I'd love to ease out of the business, frankly, but I don't quite know how. I've written very few harsh reviews. Once in a while, a book has irritated me, and I let the irritation show. But in general, I've tried to write a review that, if it won't entirely please the author, might at least instruct him or her about the impression that he or she has made on this particular reader.
Let me read a sentence from a review written by a critic with the last name of Featherweight that really sets Beck off. And the reviewer writes, "One's spirits, however initially well-disposed toward one of America's more carefully tended reputations, begin severely to sag under the repeated empathetic effort of watching Mr. Beck, page after page, strain to make something of very little. The pleasures of microscopy pall." That must have been a lot of fun to write. whose writing or criticism were you thinking of when you wrote that? Is that the kind of thing you would write in real life in a review, do you think?
I wouldn't write it, but somebody like Featherweight might. Wretched Featherweight. I remember the reviewer's name is Rabinowitz, Dorothy Rabinowitz, but I may be all wrong. It was a review, at any rate, of a short story collection called Museums and Women. And it was, like all my short story collections, I was very proud of these. They had appeared in The New Yorker mostly. I'd worked hard on them. They were polished and pretty well told the story of my life to date. And then she said this about making much of little. And that was one of the wounding reviews. It was intelligent enough to sound plausible. And yet, if true, was kind of devastating because it could apply to everything I'd written and would, in essence, wipe me off the map of serious literary consideration. So I didn't look up the review. It would still be too painful to look at it, but Featherweight's quote is something of a paraphrase of that review.
My guest is John Updike. His new book is called Beck at Bay. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Updike is my guest, and his new book is called Beck at Bay, and it continues the story of his fictional alter ego, Henry Beck. A lot of this new book is about Beck's public self. He's going on literary tours and book tours. He wins a Nobel. And it's clear that you've had more of a public life, I think, over the past decade than you had before that. And, you know, you've gotten many prizes and awards over the years. I guess, what's my question? I think you do a wonderful critique of what it's like for a writer who would just as soon not have such a public life to be forced into one all the time.
Well, one says that, and I say it to interviewers, and I say it to my wife, and I say it in print here, but if you were sincerely wish to avoid being interviewed and made much of from time to time, presumably you would be like Pynchon and Salinger and the other true recluses of our literary world and not do it. So I'm ambivalent. I think it is somewhat disgusting and demeaning for a writer to go around, in effect, selling himself. On the other hand, what is life but not an exercise in selling yourself? And if it helps the books, if it exposes me to people and landscapes I wouldn't ordinarily see, I have done it. Yes, the last 10 years, the last 20, I seem to be more invited to do this and that than I was certainly in the first 20 years of my writing life. And it's not just that my reputation, such as it is, has grown larger. It's that the literary world, I think, has grown more dependent upon author exposure, upon interviews, upon speaking appearances, upon book tours. When I began writing so long ago in the mid-50s, I never heard the phrase book tour. There were no book tours, and now everybody expects it automatically. Even my mailman says to me, "You're going on a book tour." It's become known as the thing that writers do.
In the first chapter of your new book, Beck is on a literary tour of Czechoslovakia, and he's in Prague when the book opens. And he says that he supposes it's interesting to travel to other places because you encounter your fictional selves, the refreshing false ideas of you that strangers hold in their minds. And I'm sure you encounter a lot of this, that when you go places for readings or literary dinners or whatever, people have imagined what, you know, John Updike is going to be like, and then you present the reality of yourself. Are you often surprised at what people's expectations of you are?
Yes, they expect me to be witty, and I'm not especially, maybe in print, but that takes time and mulling over, and they expect me to be rather roguish, maybe on the strength of some of my fiction, but the truth is I'm a very timid, as men go in this day and age, I'm a pretty timid, shy person with, in fact, a kind of invincible innocence. So, yes, you do encounter your literary self shining back at you from these hopeful faces, and in a way, you've had a relationship with them in that they've been reading you, and you have had none with them, so you're relatively at a disadvantage in the transaction. But on the other hand, yeah, no, it's nice. It's nice to meet people who read you and who were in some way pleased.
When Beck wins the Nobel, everybody's writing to him, making demands. They want him to do this. Everybody wants a piece of him, or they just hate him because they're jealous. So he's getting this barrage of mail that's a combination of requests and jealousy. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that chapter in which he's just basically listing the things that have been coming in the mail.
I'll try reading it. It's not easy to read. It's all in italics, and it's separated. These fragments of letters he receives are separated by dot, dot, dots, which I will read as dot, dot, dot. But this is, his winning the prize had unleashed a deluge of letters that battered him like hostile winds, I say in the authorial voice. And then we get this italic illustration. You would think that now they would give it to some American who wasn't a kike or a coon or an immigrant who can't even speak English right. Dot, dot, dot. I have been struggling to complete my novel while holding down two jobs to pay for my wife's prohibitive chemo treatments, plus the child care, and just 1% of the enormous amount you have so deservedly, in my opinion, won would enable me, dot, dot, dot. You have probably forgotten me, but I sat in the row behind you at PS 87 over on 77th in Amsterdam, and though you never paid me any attention, I always knew that someday you, dot, dot, dot. Celebrity auction, even the tiniest personal item. Last year we had remarkable good success with Mariah Carey's toenail clippings and a used paper towel from Julia Child's kitchen. Dot, dot, dot. Well, Hank, I guess you got them all fooled now except me. I still have your number, Jew boy. And it isn't number one or even 1001. Dot, dot, dot. Temple Emmanuel, our reading circle, can offer not even a modest honorarium, but your cab fare would be covered and there are home-prepared refreshments beforehand, dot, dot, dot. My son is going to be 2 this December, and a friendly note from you on your personal letterhead copying out a favorite passage from your own work or that of another great writer, and dated month and date and year, dot, 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 and so on.
I find that very funny, and I'm sure some of this... some of the requests probably came right out of your mail.
there's a lot of varied requests. You become a celebrity, and there's quite a vivacious celebrity-seeking culture out there, and even a humble writer gets a lot of requests for, you know, autographs, signed books. That's the least of it, but personal items. Would you do a doodle for a celebrity auction? I was a would-be cartoonist once, so I like to doodle skillfully. I hate to doodle carelessly, and so I don't generally doodle. And you find in yourself, however obliging you try to be, some point at which you cease to oblige the requester.
I think the Nobel is about the only literary prize that you haven't won yet. I wouldn't expect a necessarily an honest answer to this, but I mean, do you care? Do you feel like, well, I really should have won, or I want to win, or?
It's a prize that I really thought I didn't think much about until my mid-50s, when a German critic who I greatly respected assured me, sitting there in wherever it was, Frankfurt, that I was going to win the Nobel Prize because I had created a character, and almost nobody was creating characters these days. And so this little seed of irrational expectation was planted in me, but it didn't come to anything. And if I was a betting man, I wouldn't bet that it would. I think if I was going to get it, maybe I would have gotten it. I'm 66, and Nobel laureates tend to be in their early 60s or later. Some are quite young, Garcia Marquez and Albert Camus. We're both in their 40s, I try to console myself for not winning it by describing, as I do in this, the torrent of publicity, the hell of exposure that accompanies winning it.
Oh, you're just one lucky guy to not have won.
I'm one lucky guy, exactly.
when Beck is asked by one of his readers, where do you get your ideas from? He says, spite. You know, that all good ideas just come from spite, from trying to outdo your literary rivals. And I imagine that your sense of jealousy and rivalry doesn't quite measure up to his. But still, I think everybody carries around a certain amount of jealousy and rivalry. And I wonder if yours is something that you work hard at trying to transcend or whatever. I mean, how do you deal with the natural rivalry that you would feel about other writers?
One way in which I tried to deal was by asking the New Yorker not to give me any contemporary writers, American writers, to review. I just didn't quite trust myself to give them a fair shake, though I have reviewed Roth and Bellow, and maybe I didn't give them a fair shake. But yeah, that's one way in which I try to cope with my dark side. Really, I don't feel much but affection for my fellow writers. We're like astronauts in a way, in that we have been there, we know what it's like, and there aren't too many of us. So whenever I meet a fellow writer, like, say, Philip Roth, my real feelings are one of happiness, kind of a giggly good cheer. As to Beck's remark, I don't think stories or novels written out of some angry need for vengeance are generally very good. I think you should write, if you can, out of love, wish to resurrect some memory, or dress it up in different form, something positive. But Beck is not entirely wrong that spite, old wounds, getting even may play a part in some fiction, and certainly in Beck Noir, very much so. That was written in a kind of payback mode.
John Updike, his new novel is called Beck at Bay. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer John Updike. He has a new novel called Beck at Bay, his third book about his fictional alter ego, the writer Henry Beck. Updike wrote four novels about his character Harry Rabbit Angstrom. John Updike will receive the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters on November 18th. John Updike, since you've written about American presidents in your fiction, and you've also written a lot about sexual mores and changing sexual mores in America, and you really use sex to get at character in your fiction, I thought I'd ask you a couple of questions about the Clinton Lewinsky story. I think it's fair to say that some people seem particularly outraged or even disgusted by the fact that it was oral sex that the president and Monica Lewinsky engaged in. And someone who writes a sex column named Dan Savage, it's a very funny column, pointed out that it wasn't too long ago that oral sex for heterosexuals was considered really quite adventurous. And he used your first Rabbit book as an example of that, because an act of oral sex in the novel kind of changes the lives of two characters in a way. And I'm wondering,
what about oral sex? You're wondering.
Well, I'm wondering just if you have any thoughts about oral sex in that context, how you used the act in your first Rabbit book, and how people are reacting to the act now.
Yeah, my putting an act of oral sex into a would-be mainstream novel was, believe it or not, quite daring in 1960. Became less daring rather rapidly, but it was in there as a central moment in the development, in the adventures of the characters. And, my high school experience, it was talked about, oral sex talked about much more than it was committed, I dare say. But at any rate, it was something that was taboo in print. In most print, so in my modest and innocent way, I was a pioneer and have followed the career of oral sex and literature with some interest since. In fact, there's a little essay I wrote in Picked Up Pieces about a sentence in Samler's Planet, Mr. Samler's Planet by Saul Bellow, in which the magazine version is a little bolder talking about oral sex than the novel is. But now it's become fairly standard fare. You have females writing about giving oral sex to men as well as men writing about receiving it. In couples, in my novel Couples, it was meant to be one of the bonds that Pete and Foxy, the illicit couple, have between them, is that they're both happy to give it and receive it. And there's something about our amorous natures, oral sex in a way is less animal than genital copulation. It's a use of the thinking end of us in a way to explore the unthinking end. So, yeah, I have feelings about it. On the other hand, now that it's become such a feature on late night comedy shows and everything, and that it's sort of part of the news, I must say even I feel a little squeamish. There's a melancholy there's a poignance in the descriptions in the Star Report, which I've seen paraphrased in newspapers about he did this and she did that, and exactly what they did. And like all such descriptions, it acquires the melancholy of the purely physical. I mean, the president of the United States, with all the power in the world, was reduced to the kind of contact that adolescents in high school corridors have to be satisfied with. And the whole thing made me embarrassed and sad, and I kind of wished it weren't in print. But anyway, my own fictional descriptions of the thing have been a serious attempt to explore our sexual natures and why oral sex is important to many of us.
You know, so much has hinged on what is the definition of sex, and is oral sex sex? Have you had characters in your novels who have had oral sex thinking that it wasn't as serious in terms of betraying their marriage, had oral sex outside of marriage and felt that it wasn't as serious a betrayal as if they had had intercourse?
No, I must say that never occurred to me or my characters that it was somehow more innocent than genital sex, or less sex than genital sex. I think because it does involve the head, I think it's rather more intimate, less brutish, more potentially meaningful. And no, I don't buy that. If Clinton had that in mind when he was telling us he didn't have an affair with Monica Lewinsky, I think it was mighty intricate thinking.
Well, you have a new editor at your home base of many years, The New Yorker. Any thoughts on David Remnick as editor of the magazine?
I admire him as a writer, of course, and like him as a person, and think that the morale in the staff, insofar as I can detect it, is very upbeat, very intelligent, able young man. I'm just surprised that he wants to take on such a potentially, a big job as editing The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be thought to be that was all a man could do. Certainly the way William Shawn did it was sort of morning to midnight task, and I admire his willingness to take it on. And it's nice, always nice to have an editor who has been on the writing side of things, I believe.
Well, John Updike, one small, quick question for you. The pages of your new Beck book are kind of gold-edged on the top of the page. Did you notice that? I was wondering if you were in on that at all. I haven't seen that in a long time in a book.
It's what's called in the trade a top stain. A top stain used to be a common feature of books where they spray some color. It needn't be gold. It can be red, blue, green. I've had them all. And an early feature of my books at Knopf was that the top stain, then more ordinary, was done. I've actually been to a printing house and seen it done. You'd have a stack of books and some poor devil stands there all day long with a spray can spraying this one edge of the stacks of, of signatures, and that gives you the top stain. It's not an effect I'm wild about. I wouldn't stop writing if they stopped giving me the top stain, but they see me as a top stain kind of guy, and so that's why it's there.
John Updike, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
John Updike's new novel about his literary alter ego, Henry Beck, is called Beck at Bay. This is Fresh Air.